I'd like to take a look at something in this week's parasha, which, by the way, is just jam-packed of great stuff. And I will be honest with you, I feel a little sad whenever we get to this parasha, because as amazing and enthralling as Sefer Shemot is, it's difficult to say goodbye to Sefer Bereshit. But nonetheless, say goodbye we must, so we'll hopefully do it with good spirit. Perhaps the central scene in Sefer Bereshit is Yaakov's deathbed wish, blessing, ethical will, whatever you want to call it, assignment of tasks to his sons. And we're going to take a look at the first three sections, really, here, with an eye towards one particular line that Yaakov gives as a blessing to Yehuda, and a little bit of the history of Parshanut, and perhaps a new perspective on understanding what it means. It is a phrase, like much of biblical poetry, that is subject to a wide range of interpretation, lots of speculation, and bottom line, nobody really knows for sure. And biblical poetry shows up a little bit here and there at the beginning of Bereshit. Lamech has that line he says to his wives, etc. We have, of course, the brachot that are given that Yitzchak gives to Esav, thinking it's Esav, then to really Esav, then to really Yaakov, and then the various brachot that Hashem gives along the way, including especially to Yaakov, and then of course we have the scene before this, which is Yaakov and Menashe and Ephraim, and we talked about that last year and what Yaakov was trying to accomplish with that. But perhaps the most powerful expression of this whole thing is the bracha that Yaakov gives to his sons. Vayikra Yaakov el banav vayomer he'asfu v'yagid alachem et asher yikra etchem b'acharit hayamim. So this is subsequent to the scene that we saw last year with Menashe and Ephraim, etc. And as I said, etc., because Yosef's in that scene also. And Yaakov summons his sons, and he says, gather, and I will tell you what's going to happen b'acharit hayamim. Now, before we go any further, let's think about what that phrase means. What does acharit hayamim mean?
Later days.
Okay, so acharit hayamim either means later days or end of days. And there's a critical distinction between them. How would we understand what Yaakov's about to talk about if we understand acharit hayamim as it appears in Yeshayahu and in other Nevi'im as meaning end of days, eschaton, the end of the world? How would we understand what Yaakov's about to talk about? The messianic era, whatever that may mean, right? If, on the other hand, acharit hayamim means the end of a particular era, then we'd have to define what era it is, and then understand what it is that Yaakov intends to present. And that's going to take us in the following directions. If we understand that acharit hayamim means end of days, then we have one of two options here. Option one is that somehow buried in these brachot are prophetic statements that foretell things that are going to happen at the end of history. That's kind of hard because we'd have to do a lot of digging to find them in there, but that's the nature of prophecy, is that it's somewhat obscure. The other possibility is to say that that's what Yaakov intended to do. And this is Rashi's direction here. Rashi says that Bikesh Yaakov legalot et haketz, Yaakov wanted to reveal the end of days, and Nistalka Shechina upana ledvarim acherim. He was about to talk about Mashiach and end of history and all, and then the Shechina left him, and that prophetic spirit left him. So he turned to other things, and he started talking to his sons about their own things. So that's one general direction to take. And that's, by the way, the mainstream direction. The acharit hayamim really refers to the end of history. And then you have one of two possibilities. Either what we're reading here is some prophetic revelation about the end of history, and we got to dig and find out what it means. Or that was Yaakov's intent, and it didn't happen. And the next pasuk would either signal the next piece or the switch. So listen and attend to me, your father. And then he talks to Reuven, then Shimon and Levi together, then Yehuda, and on and on. And a few years ago, we even talked about the structure of this and the sequence of it and what Yaakov was trying to establish by sequencing the way that he did. But now we're going to focus really on one particular line in Yehuda. So he begins by talking to Reuven, and immediately takes Reuven down several pegs. And as we read explicitly in Divrei Hayamim Aleph, Perek Hey, Pasuk Aleph, Reuven is Bechor Yisrael, Uvachalo Yitzue Aviv, Nina Bechorato Livnei Yosef. That Reuven was the Bechor, but because he violated his father's bed, the story of Bilhah, so it's an explicit statement, as a result of that, he lost the Bechorah and it went to Yosef. Here we see it in more poetic terms, Pachaz Kamayim Al Totar, Ki Alita Mishkevei Avicha, Az Chilalta Yitzui Allah. What Allah means itself is almost every one of the words in this entire section is subject to lots of interpretation, because that's the nature of biblical poetry, and there are double entendres and triple entendres and multiple meanings that are possible. But the simple read of this is you rushed like water, in other words, you had no patience, and as a result of it, you violated your father's bed, and therefore you lost the Bechorah. Shimon v'Levi achim klei chamas becherot to him, and we spoke about this a few weeks ago when we talked about the different brothers at the Borot, right? Ish al achiv, and Shimon and Levi are immediately discounted from leadership. Not only that, but they are separated from each other and they are dispersed in of themselves. There's two breakups here. Shimon v'Levi, Shimon and Levi are brothers who are separated from each other because they're a dangerous mix. And they are also dispersed, so that Shimon has no land, just has cities among Yehuda, and Levi doesn't even have that. They have cities around everywhere, spread out throughout the country, as you read in Yoshua Chafalef. We get to Yehuda. Yehuda clearly is made into the leader of the family. And Yehuda, Tayu Ducha, and we talked about this last week in the context of that story of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai and Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda, how the story mirrored the scene where Yehuda is elevated and Yosef is in charge of exile and Shimon is the one who is sort of demoted. Yehuda, ta yuducha chacha, yadcha ba'orf oivecha, yishtachavu lecha b'nei avicha. All right, and a couple years ago, actually last year, earlier, in the context of Parshat Vayeshev, we spoke about what Yehuda did to earn this particular position was actually the fact that he made treaties with others, as opposed to Shimon and Levi. His approach to others was to create bonds and alliances, and that's the Achecha here. Achecha is not Bnei Avicha, but rather his allies. Gur Aryeh Yehuda Miterf Bnei Alita. He's like a lion. He rises up from the hunt, from the ripping apart the dead animal that he's hunted. And just like a lion, nobody can raise him. He gets up when he wants to. It's sort of like the 500-pound gorilla. Where does he sleep? Wherever he wants to. Exactly. And this is the key line. And this is the line, by the way, that has been used as a Christological reference and something that we often had to defend against in the Middle Ages. It is a line that was used to promote all sorts of messianic aspirations. Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda. Now the word shevet's an interesting word. What is a shevet? So you hear shevet, what's your immediate reaction? Tribe. A shevet actually means a staff. A staff. And you say it every year, every week on Shal Zodis, Shiftecha Mishantecha Im Anachamuni, Psalm 23, thy rod and thy staff. So how did shevet become a tribe? All right, and by the way, there's a related word, which is that a bet and a pay in Hebrew are interchangeable, and a shofet is related to the word shevet. That a tribe is a group that coalesces around the man who holds the staff. The staff is the sign of leadership. Shofet's the same thing. It's a leader. And so a lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda, the simplest read of this is that the scepter shall not depart from Yehuda. Now what does that mean? Does that mean that Yehuda right now is being made king and will never cease being king? Is this a prophecy or is it a directive? And it's a huge difference, because if it's a prophecy, the minute that you see a leader who's not Yehuda, you say, well, that prophecy didn't really happen, unless there's a terminus ad quem, and there's an end point to the prophecy. If, on the other hand, it's a directive, then we got to turn around and say, well, maybe the children don't follow the directive if they name somebody else to be leaders. Indeed, that's the Ramban here who talks about the negatives of Chanukah. He says, because the Bnei Yisrael allowed Kohanim to become kings and violated Avru al mitzvat avihem. They violated their father's directive, which is that Yehuda should be the king. So one way to look at it is it's a directive. The other way is to look at it, it's prophetic. But of course, everything's going to hinge back on the first thing I mentioned, which is what is Acharit HaYamim? And when is this directive slash prophecy geared to? To what time frame? Okay. So lo yasur shevet miyuda u'mechokek mibein raglav. U'mechokek is a lawgiver. So a king is a lawgiver. Mibein raglav, from between his legs, is a sense of his dynasty. In other words, his progeny will always be the lawgivers, the kings. Ad ki avo shilo v'lo yikatamim. And that's the phrase that really everybody goes crazy about, and we don't really know what it means. Ad ki avo shilo. I'm not even going to try. I didn't translate it here because, I mean, how do you translate it? I could translate it until he comes to Shiloh, in which case you got to wonder, who's the he, and why is he coming to Shiloh? Does Shiloh exist at the time, of Yaakov? Does Shiloh mean something else? Is Shiloh have it refer to something, or does it actually have a different meaning as a word? Right? And the end of it, v'lo yikahatamim, and nations will gather to him. Who's the him? So the him here seems to be Yehuda. You understand, by the way, why the Christians love this pasuk, right? And why it's very, very important that Jesus be a descendant of David, as the beginning of Matthew has that whole lineage. Of course, it kind of gets interrupted at the end, where it says, who gave birth to Joseph, the husband of Mary, the mother, right? That's when the breakup happens, right? But, and anyhow, that's a whole different shiur that I'm not going to give. But, ad ki avo shilo v'lo yikatamim. And then the end of the bracha seems to be describing the land that Yaakov is giving to Yehuda. Osirila gefen iro v'la soreka b'ni atono. His donkeys are laden with these grapes. Ki beis b'yayin levusho v'dam anavim suto. That he washes his clothes in wine and with the blood of grapes, as it were. His garments, chachlili einayim inayin uven shinayim echalav, and it describes, essentially, in a very poetic terms, a land that is just rife with grapes and with milk. Milk, you have to remember, in Tanakh is not cow's milk. Milk in Tanakh is goat's milk. So what we're talking about is an area that has lots and lots of grazing going on and lots of vineyards going on. And if you look at Eretz Yehuda today, you will see both of them throughout the area, from Gush Etzion all the way down to Hebron. There are wineries aplenty, and lots of goats grazing and giving milk. Okay, but it's the pasuk in the middle that we really want to focus on, Ad Ki Avo Shiloh. And just to show you how problematic the pasuk is, we're going to survey a little bit of the parshanut, and you will see how wide the range is. Now, this is an important methodological point in studying Tanakh. When you're studying Tanakh, and you look at what a particular phrase may mean, or a particular word may mean, and there are very few comments on it in your traditional Mikraot Gedolot and other traditional commentaries, and they're all pretty much saying the same thing, you know, and then maybe there's one out there who's got some sort of interesting take, then you know that the statement is fairly transparent. It's fairly easy to decipher. Nobody's giving really a lot of attention to the meaning of the words. They might put attention to something else, and there's not really a whole lot to dispute. The wider the range of interpretations, the more obscure and translucent, or shall I, opaque, is the phrase. You take a look at this page, and this is a small sampling of Ad Ki Avo Shiloh. All right, let's start with Unklus. Now, Unklus is not the oldest commentary we have here, it's the oldest commentary on the page. Unklus's comment, and one time we'll do a shiur perhaps on what Targum Unklus is, but I will tell you this, that a friend of mine, we were at a seminar last summer, we were sitting at lunch, and he asked me the following question. What does Shmona Esrei, Targum Unklus, Targum Yonatan, and Mezonot Bread have in common? Right? The answer is that none of them exist. Right? How many brachot do we say in Tefillah every day? 19. There's no Shmona Esrei. Right? Mezonot Bread is a nice fiction of the perhaps, according to many, that for the airlines. There's a very cute story there of Lichtenstein, as Zatzal was on a plane. And, you know, he didn't look like a rabbi to most people because he was clean-shaven. And he was getting up to trying to wash. And the stewardess said, you know, what are you doing, sir? He says, well, I'm trying to find some water. I can wash my hands for the meal. He said, oh, no. The rabbi said that it's mezonos bread. You don't have to wash. Look who you're talking to. Anyhow, so, well, that's another shiur for another time. But anyhow, where Targum Unklus comes from and when it's dated from, etc., it's probably a few centuries later, and probably from Babylonia. Nonetheless, what we do find in Targum Unklus, which has a tradition of interpretation, and important to note, Targum Unklus is not a strict translation when it comes to both poetry and any mentions of God, then Unklus gets interpretive. Right? And for instance, any physical mentions of God, unklus immediately turns into a figurative phrase. Right? So here, how does he interpret it? Ad yete mashicha, the delay himalchuta. So what's ad ki avo shilo? He says that Yehuda will be the king until the Mashiach comes, because the kingdom belongs to him. So how is he interpreting Shiloh? Somehow, Shiloh has become some sort of a nickname for Mashiach, or some sort of reference to Mashiach. We don't know how, but that's what he says. Open up your Chumash to Shnei Mikrovecha Targum this week, and you get to this Pasuk, that's what you'll have. Rashi, we always like to start with Rashi, gives two interpretations about Ad Ki Yavo Shiloh. Now the fact that Rashi gives two interpretations doesn't tell me that I'm in this quagmire, but it should be a little bit of a hint. All right, the first is Melech HaMashiach Shem Lucha Shiloh. So now Rashi helps us, and he says, V'chein tirgem unklus. Rashi helps us understand what unklus meant. How did he get from Shiloh to Mashiach? He said, Mashiach shamachut Shiloh belongs to him. So Shiloh becomes like Shiloh. Of course, the big problem is that in biblical Hebrew, the word shel doesn't exist, really, except very, very late Hebrew. How do you say it belongs to him? In Hebrew, you say asher le, not she. She is a later construct, but okay. When Midrash Agadah, and now, so Rashi's saying that this is pshat, what's the Midrash Agadah? Shiloh. By the way, think Neil Diamond. Remember the song? Okay, Shiloh, and I was, okay. How did Americans pronounce the name of that town? I think it's a town in Kentucky. Shiloh. All right, that was a battlefront in the Civil War.
Shiloh.
Right, Shiloh. So Rashi says, Shiloh, right? What's Shiloh? Because, and by the way, this is supported by the fact that in the Torah, the name Shiloh in this pasuk is written with a vav, not a hey. We pronounce it in the traditional way, but it's written with a vav. So the play is Shiloh, meaning a gift comes to him. The word shy is a biblical word for gift, right? And he quotes a pasuk in Tehillim, Yovilu Shai Lamorah. They will bring a gift to the one that they fear. All right, so that's Midrash Agadah. Again, this is all messianic then. And therefore, in the end of times, there will be a great leader who will be from Yehuda, who will be Mashiach, and all the nations will come and bring him gifts. Beautiful. The Rashbam, and you're not surprised by this, goes in a very different direction. He moves away from end of days scenario, which means either that Acharit HaYamim meant end of days, and Yaakov then was detoured from that, or else that Yaakov never meant end of days. He just meant, I'll tell you what's going to happen later on in history. It takes us in a very different direction. So let me ask you, once Yehuda was crowned as leader, how long did that maintain as the sole leader of the Jewish people? Two generations, David and Shlomo. And then the kingdom was split. Where was the kingdom split? So it's an interesting story. If I was to ask you, we've talked about this numerous times in other contexts. If I was to ask you, what is the center of Eretz Yisrael? What would you say? Naturally, you'd say Yerushalayim. Kind of our heart just answers. But it's not actually true. If you look at it, both geographically, commercially, and historically, the center of Eretz Yisrael is Shechem. It's Shechem. And Shechem is right at the crossroads of the mountain range and the great spice and all the trade routes that come across come through Shechem. The road that goes there is called Derech Mevo HaShemesh. We have that road today, although I don't think you can go on most of it safely anymore. In the meantime. So the Rashbam picks up the following. In source 3, HaMalchut HaNitan Lo V'Yishtachavot Lo Kol Achav, Shnei Masar, this rule that Yehuda is going to have, where all 12 of his brothers, interesting, 12 of his brothers, Nehinu, Menashe, and Ephraim, will bow to him, Lo Tifsot Mimenu Kol Ota Agdula, this will not cease from him or his children. Ad ki avo Yehuda Shiloh. Until when? Ad ki avo Melech Yehuda. Hu Rechavam ben Shlomo. Who is the king of Yehuda who loses the kingdom? Rechavam, Shlomo's son. Rechavam took the bad advice of his friends instead of the older people's advice, and he increased the taxes on the people. He threatened to, and that was the end of that. Sheba l'chadesh hamlucha b'shiloh. Well, it's not exactly true, because he came to Shechem, not Shiloh. Shezeo karov l'shechem. The Rashbam says, okay, Shiloh, Shechem, and they're near each other. Not exactly true. Shiloh is in whose territory, by the way? It's in Ephraim's. Shechem is in Menashe. They are not super far from each other, but they're not right next door. Right? Aval az yasur aseret hashvatim imenu. So now, By the way, this prophecy is read not as an affirmation of Yehuda's rule, but as giving a terminus to it and saying Yehuda will be the ruler until, and then they're going to separate, and the other tribes are going to break off and start their own kingdom. And this is a prophecy of the splitting of the kingdom. And Ad Kivo Shiloh, now Shiloh is now the place Shiloh, and it is plus minus Shechem, you know, near Shechem. All right? The Ramban goes in the Messianic direction. The Radak takes a different approach. He says, you know what Shiloh is? He says, Shiloh is from the word Shiliah. And a Shiliah is a baby. We find that word in Dvarim Chafchet, with Shiliata Hayotzet in Ben Ragueha. A baby, like a placenta really, is a Shiliah. And so Ad Ki Yavo Shiloh means until that final son is born, and that son is the Mashiach. The Chizkuni goes back, and by the way, I'm doing this mainly just to demonstrate to you that there's this wide range of interpretation. Is Shiloh the name of a place? Is Shiloh a hint to Shiloh? Is Shiloh an allusion to Shiloh? Is Shiloh an allusion to Shiliah? Or again, the location? And we're going to yet see another approach. The Chizkuni gives two interpretations. By the way, you see this commonly among the Farshim, that when it comes to this pasuk, say this, and then there's another one. Ki az nechleka machut beit David v'nitna li ravam machut aser ha-shvatim v'zeo ad ki yavo Shiloh, and he takes the Rashbam's approach. Shiloh is near Shechem, and that's what we're referring to. Davar acher ad ki yavo Shiloh achia ha-shiloni. And this one, actually, brings us really back to the place of Shiloh. Shiloh is famous for us because it was the location of the Mishkan for several hundred years, and because it's the location where the whole Chana scene happened. Chana and Elkanah came up, and Chana prayed, and after on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, and then Shmuel was born, and Shmuel is operating in Shiloh for a little bit of time, and then Shiloh is destroyed, and we don't hear about it again, sort of. We do hear a little bit, and we're going to see that. But there is a person who comes from Shiloh who plays a critical role in this scene of splitting it up. What happened? There's a fellow from Shevet Ephraim named Yeravam ben Nevat, who's actually a pretty good worker for Shlomo. And he's walking out there, and after Shlomo has done whatever he's done, all the bad things he's done, Achiyah Shiloni, a prophet named Achiyah from Shiloh, approaches him and tells him, I'm giving you most of Am Yisrael, but only as a temporary thing in order to punish Beit David for what Shlomo did. I'm going to wait till Shlomo dies and give it to you, etc. Right? And then the entire scene is generated by a prophet named Achiyah from Shiloh. Achiyah Shiloni. It says, Ad ki yavo Shiloh now means until the Shilonite comes and breaks up the kingdom, as it were. Okay, then the Sforno takes us in yet another direction. And again, I'm doing this just to demonstrate the wide range of interpretation. Ad ki yavo Shiloh. Hinetemat Shiloh morkevet mishoresh shul. He says Shiloh comes from the word shul, meaning shulayim, meaning that at the very end, shalom. Ad ki yavo Shiloh, until finally at the end there'll be peace, which is nobody that I know of. I haven't seen anybody who supports this interpretation. It's a weird etymology. But nonetheless, it's taking you off into yet another direction. So because we only have about eight or different interpretations, so I have to add another one. But it all starts from the question about Be'acharit HaYamim. And I believe that perhaps we get bribed, I don't know any better word, get blindered, if you will, get blinders put on when we see the word Be'acharit HaYamim, because we know what Be'acharit HaYamim is. We know it very well from all sorts of literature in Tanakh, Be'acharit HaYamim, the end of days. And the end of days is the Messianic era. So when we see what is going to happen, Be'acharit HaYamim, we immediately assume that this entire prophecy, this entire directive, whatever it is speaking about a Messianic era. And then the question is, does Yaakov intend to direct things starting now till then? Or starting at some later point till then? And then there are those who say Be'acharit HaYamim is either not about the Messianic era or that Yaakov was talking about something else, was directed differently, and says, oh, this is referring to the kingdom once established, how long it's going to last. And all of them seem to point to the breakup of the kingdom as being the end of that. So Ad Ki Yavo Shiloh then becomes until Rechavam came to Shechem, and either Shechem is near Shiloh, or the prophet who sent your Avam is from Shiloh, right? That's going to be the breakup of the kingdom. So it either means Yehuda will be king from some point, we don't know when, until this Shiloh trauma happens, or else Yehuda will be king from some point until the end of days when Shiloh will be experienced, which is all a great thing. There's something essential missing from this entire piece, which is, what's going to happen right now? So let's walk into the story. Here's Yaakov on his deathbed. What does Yaakov imagine for the next era? Yaakov's dying. What's his famous last request? Take me back to Marat HaMachpelah to be buried there. What does he then envision is going to happen with his kids? So he imagines that at some point, soon, his kids are going to have the opportunity, one way or the other, to pick up and leave. The famine's long over. For whatever reason, they're in Egypt because they're connected to Yosef. At some point soon, they're going to pick up and leave. Slavery hasn't yet started. We're at it right now at a golden era where, by the way, most of Egypt are slaves, except for the priests and except for Yosef's family. It wouldn't be a great time to leave. But that's what Yaakov imagines. So what is it that he's picturing for his sons that he's setting up now? Reuven, sorry, you're out. Shimon Levi, you guys get away from each other and get away from leadership. Yehuda, you the man. And by the way, Yosef, you the man in exile. While we're in exile, you're in charge, but Yehuda, you the man. Ad ki avo Shiloh. What does that mean? So I'm going to ask a whole different question, which is, when Bnei Yisrael come into Eretz Yisrael, they are told, and please take a look at the back page. If you take a look at source 13, they are told that when you come to the land, God is going to choose a place, and that is the only place you may bring offerings. The famous centralization of worship. That place is not identified. The place that God shall choose to put his name is emphasized over and over in Sefer Devarim. It doesn't appear in any other Sefer, but in Devarim it's emphasized over and over. So Bnei Yisrael come to Eretz Yisrael. Where should they go? So there's two options. Either they should wait for some sort of a divine sign telling them where to go, or else they should select a place. Take a look at source 8. What happens in Israel when they finish conquering the land? Vayikaluko adab in Israel Shiloh, vayashkinu sham eto amoed. By the way, it's the first time we ever heard of Shiloh. There's no battles in Shiloh, in Yoshua. Shiloh's mentioned in Perek. I think that Zion is one of the towns of Ephraim, but that's it. Tanat Shiloh. But they come to Shiloh and they put up the Ormoid there. Why? We don't find Yeshua coming and saying, Komar Hashem, Hamakoma Shemachai, which by the way, we do find in the context of Yerushalayim. And we find a sign. The Malach is hovering over the Goren and God says to David, build him his Beach there. And there's all of these divine signs indicating Yerushalayim is the place. We don't have that for Shiloh. Why do they set it up in Shiloh? Why Shiloh? And Shiloh remains the place. And they don't leave because of a choice, they leave because it's destroyed. And then there's sort of no man's land, no man's time, in which there's a Bamayin Nov and a Bamayin Givon, etc., until finally Yerushalayim is selected, and that's it forever. But why Shiloh? So I'd like to suggest that what's happening here is the following. Let's go back and ask the question. Are we one nation? If you look at Sefer Devarim, we are clearly not one nation. If you look at Sefer Devarim, we are 12 nations. Everything is set up in the ideal, in Devarim, and Yehoshua and Shoftim all push in this direction, to live as tribes. That every tribe has its own courts and its own justice system, etc. And there's a central place of worship where all the tribes meet. We definitely share a constitution, we share a belief, etc., but we live tribally. Matter of fact, think about this. When Shimshon finds that the Plishta girl so cute and wants to marry her, what do his parents say? So what do Jewish parents say today when their kid says, you know, there's a non-Jewish girl I want to marry? What do they say? You can't find a Jewish girl. What do his parents say? You can't find a girl from Shevet Dan? Not a Jewish girl. Shevet Dan, because we're Shevet Dan. That's everything that's identified. And in look through Sefer Shoftim, which of course is not an ideal period, but everything is tribal. A particular tribe is oppressed, and occasionally other tribes will come in to help, and sometimes other tribes will come in and help the oppressors and fight against the tribe.
How do you see that as applicable today?
I don't. I don't know what to do with it today. I know what to do with it in the story itself. And so when you ask the question, what is the image, what is the ideal picture of how we as a ethnicity, whatever you want to call it, should be, it seems to be tribal, meaning by tribes. However, there is a critical period during which we have to operate together. What's that period? From whenever we leave until we finish conquering the land and settle the land. And by the way, that's exactly what happens in Sefer Yehoshua. We work together as an army. We even get the East Bank tribes to come and fight with us while their families stay on the East Bank. And we fight and we conquer. And what do we do exactly when we're done conquering? Yehoshua sends everybody to their Nahala. And then we have chapter after chapter describing each Shevet's territory, what cities are in it, what are the boundaries of it are, and that's where they go. And that's how Sefer Shoftim entirely operates. It's only really with David that the nation is brought together. Not even Shaul, but the nation is actually brought together, and there's a sense of a unified government, which then leads to the building of the Mikdash. Okay, so here's Yaakov, and that seems to be what he's envisioning, because he's parceling out different tasks for the different sons. Somebody's got to be in charge. So I'd like to suggest that what Yaakov is doing is sort of an inverse of what we thought. Yaakov is saying, Yehuda ata yaducha achecha, you, not your children, you're in charge. Yalcha b'arfavecha, you're going to lead the war. And by the way, Moshe follows this directive exactly. Which camp marches first throughout the desert? Machane Yehuda, led by Yehuda. They're the ones who lead. And in the conquest in Eretz Yisrael, the first psukim in Sefer Shoftim, mi yalama b'tchila, Yehuda yala. Yehuda leads the battle. So they're the first ones. How long are we going to have to stay together? As long as we're fighting. But you don't need to have one tribe be over the others or one person to be king over the others if they are 12 different nations. So therefore, they're only going to need to have a leader until such time as they've conquered the land, and then they separate. What's going to be the sign that they've finished conquering the land? Peace. Sefer Devarim says, when you find respite and rest in the land, then you'll set up the place that God chooses.
Shiloh.
Yaakov says, you know where I want you to set it up? I want you to set it up in Shiloh. Why Shiloh? Why Shiloh? Where is Shiloh? Shiloh is a little bit north of Beit El. On the road from Shechem to Beit El. That's where Shiloh is. Why is that so important? Let's go back to the very beginning. Take a look in Source 9. Hashem tells Avram, Lech Lecha. Avram picks up and leaves from Turkey, from Haran, and comes south. And where's the first place Hashem appears to him? In Shechem. And says, I'm giving your kids this land. He builds a Mizbeach, keeps moving south. And then he stops and builds a Mizbeach, Bein Beit El Uvein Ha'ai, not far from Shiloh. And he calls out in Hashem's name. And then there's a famine. He goes down to Egypt. Egypt happens. And then Avram comes back to where? Look very carefully. It's in Pasuk Dalet. El Mekom HaMizbeach Asher Asah Sham Barishona. He comes back to that same spot. That seems to be the place where Avram creates his center. That might even be the place where Avram and Lot were looking together when Avram said, you go this way, I go that way, and Lot went to stone, and Avram stayed. That seems to be Avram's center. And by the way, God is going to select a place. What else does God select? Please take a look in Pasuk number in choice 10. So selection 10. Atahu Adonai Elohim asher bacharta bi Avram. God selected Avram, and God selected a place. And who selected that place to define it? Avram. Avram defined a place. Shiloh. And how do I know that Shiloh has some inherent significance? Because in a very moving passage in Yirmiyahu Perek Zayin, when the people are all saying, God's never going to destroy his own home. Ain't going to happen. You're telling us, Yirmiyahu, that God's going to destroy the Beit HaMikdash. No way would he destroy his own home. We can continue being as we are, not to worry. What does Yirmiyahu tell them? Take a look in Pasuk, in Sephashes 11. Ki lechuna el mikomi asher b'shilo. Go look at my place, my holy place, in Shiloh. I put my name there. But because of your sins, I destroyed it. And indeed, in Tehillim Ayin Chet, we hear that God abandoned Shiloh. Shiloh is an inherently holy place that God chose. Why did God choose it? Because that's where Avram set up his Mizbeach. God chooses Avram. God chooses to put his name where Avram put his name. Put the Mizbeach. So what does Yaakov say? When you go back to Eretz Yisrael, I want you, and you conquer it. After you conquer it, I want you to set up the Mishkan, your center, your religious center in Shiloh. And until then, Yehuda's in charge. Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda michokot mibein raglav, meaning it's Yehuda or his sons or his grandsons will be the leaders. Ad ki yavo Shiloh, until you arrive at Shiloh. And then it becomes moot. V'lo yikat amim. Who are the amim who gather? So you have to remember that the word am in Tanakh does not mean nation. The word am almost always in Tanakh means army. V'lo yikat amim. All of the armies will gather to him, meaning the armies of Menashe and Ephraim and Binyamin, etc., will gather to him, and that's where they'll disband, and every Shevet will go to his own place, and Yehuda will no longer need to be the king. So Ad Ki Yavo Shiloh is not imagining a messianic in the way we think of it, future, but rather is imagining perhaps what Yaakov sees as the messianic future, which is, right now we're in Egypt, it's not where we need to be. In a generation or two or three, we're going to return. Yehuda, you're in charge, you lead the way. Moshe does that, and Yehuda leads the way. And Yehuda's going to lead the way as long as there's a need for one leader. That need for one leader breaks apart when you've conquered the land and you go to your tribes. The interesting thing is that then Shmuel regenerates it, and who does he name to be the leader once the nation realizes that tribalism doesn't work, and they come to Shmuel and say, we want a king. What's pshat, we want a king? We want to have a single nation under one king, not to live tribally. Shoftim didn't work. So who does Shmuel pick? David. From Shevet Yehuda. Directly from Peretz, and that lineage is critical because what it does is it resuscitates, it revives Yaakov's directive, and then turns it from past into the future, and then all the messianic expectations are created.